Several years ago, a revealing book was published entitled The Day America Told the Truth. This was maybe, I think, early to mid-1990s that it came out. And in that book, results were tabulated of endless polls that were taking place across the United States, interviewing thousands of Americans, asking them many different questions on many different topics. And one of the questions that came up was, what would you do for $10 million? And apparently, the results were quite shocking. 16% would give up their U.S. citizenship. 25% would abandon the family. 23% would turn to prostitution. 16% would leave mates. 10% would withhold testimony in a trial to let the murderer go free. 7% said that they would kill a stranger. 3% would put their own children up for adoption. Now, how in the world can such a thing occur? Because $10 million is their God. In one study that was done many years ago in a different part of the U.S., where money was very, very scarce, it was determined that 90% of that particular region did not have, the people did not have TV sets. However, almost everybody had a TV antenna on their roof. Why would that happen? Because as a false idol, they had status in mind. And it has nothing to do with how much money somebody has, it's all in the mind. It's amazing what people have done with false gods that they've worshipped. People have gone to war over false idols and sporting events. In Honduras and Salvador, I learned on my first visit down in Central America that those two countries went to war over the results of a soccer game. I guess soccer was their god. Some people have trampled others to death in crowds to get to rock stars that they adulated. Others have conquered territory, climbed political ladders, formed mafias for false idols. Idols of power, political status, idols of social status, idols of artists and musicians and sports athletes, money, and movie stars, and the like. For any of us, a car could be an idol, a job, a person, even inanimate objects. I don't know of anything that upsets God more than to see people given over to idolatry. Wholesale. He has a lot to say about that. It just seems to, that plus the claim that God does not exist, I think irritates him more than anything. And God is the God that is slow to wrath, but he spills out through the inspiration of the pen of the prophets how he feels about such a concept. In Isaiah chapter 40, we can read about this, and I think the value of something, a subject like this, is so that we, looking at the holy day season that we're entering, consider what false idols might we have? What do we need to get rid of? Very important. And false idols can develop subtly over time, but they can be very blatant to God. And with God's inspiration, maybe they can be blatant and obvious enough to us so that we're careful and so that we don't either develop any or that we can walk away from false idols that could encumber our relationship with God. So in Isaiah chapter 40, let's begin in verse 15. Here, he makes some majestic statements. He says, "Behold, the nations are as a drop in the bucket, and are counted as a small dust in the balance. Behold, he takes up the isles as a very little thing." I love that verse. And it just shows the greatness of God. And he did create the universe. And he knows every star by name. It says that multiple places in the Bible. He has an infinite mind that we cannot even imagine, fathom, comprehend in any way. That he knows every hair on our head. He's got the incredible memory that he does. To know where everything is that he's created. And the Hubble spacecraft continues to discover not just other stars, but galaxies of stars. And he knows all the names of all of those. It's just so infinite, so enormous. And so the nations are but as a drop in the bucket, and counted as a small thing. Verse 16, Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor the beast thereof sufficient for a burnt offering. All nations are before him as nothing, and they are counted to him nothing in vanity. To whom then will you liken God, and to what likeness shall you compare him to? The workman melts a graven image, and the goldsmith spreads it over with gold and casts silver chains. And he that is so impoverished that he has no oblation chooses a tree that will not rot, and seeks him a cunning workman to prepare graven images that shall not be moved. We were down in Colombia one time in Bogota. They have the Gold Museum, which is a collection of some of the greatest treasures on this earth from the Inca Empire. And you walk in there, and it's all pitch black. And then the lights slowly come on in the special room. There's armed guards all around there. Nobody's going to get away with anything. And then you see this incredible panorama all around you of all these artifacts made out of gold. And you're struck by immediately the beauty of gold and what you realize is an incredible concentration of wealth. And you look, and they're all graven images. They're all some of the many gods of the Inca Empire. And a lot of good those gods did them when the Spanish conquistadores came from Spain. But that was the heart and core of their worship system. And so many different civilizations have done that. And you read in the Bible where that was the case. You can read in great as Diana of the Ephesians, they said. You know, thousands of people shouting that in the town square. And that's recorded in the book of Acts. And so there have been many different worship efforts on pagan gods, man-made gods, graven images, and that still goes on today. Still goes on today. So God says that this is what people do. Verse 21, have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been taught to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundation of the earth? It is he that sits on the circle of the earth, and the great inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers that stretch out the heavens as a curtain and spreads out to them as a tent to dwell in. That brings the princes to nothing. He makes the judges of the earth as vanity. This is God by comparison to his creation. Yes, they shall not be planted. They shall not be sown. Yes, their stock shall not be take root in the earth. And he shall also bow upon them, and they shall wither. And the whirlwind should take away his stubble. To whom then will you liken me, or shall I be equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high, and behold, who has created these things that brings out their hosts by number, that knows every star by name, the greatness of his might, for he is strong in power. So he knows everything, and he can do everything. He is the great God, and there is none else. And throughout the next few pages of the prophecies of Isaiah, he says that over and over again. Again, I think that it just irritates him to see whole civilizations give themselves over to graven images, man-made objects, trinkets by comparison. Not that we would do that, but idols can take subtle form and creep up on people. But as we go through this Passover season, we need to make it a goal to identify whatever false idols are in our lives and do what we can with God's help to get rid of them. God hates idolatry. It is part of the Ten Commandments to have no other idols in front of the true God. And idolatry he detests for a number of reasons, one of which is it hurts the worshiper. It hurts the worshiper, can hurt us if we do that. Knowing this group, I know that no one would ever do that intentionally. But God is concerned. It also is a problem in that it separates a person from God. It is sin. And many times, idolatry hurts the worshiper And not just the worshiper, it can hurt many other people. And since God is perfect, he doesn't, you can't say that God has an ego. He sees nothing wrong with, he encourages us to worship him. If any human did, we would know that there's something wrong. But God is not that way. And in several places of the Bible, he talks about the fact that he is a jealous God. And we can look over to Exodus 20, where the Ten Commandments are listed, and read what he said to ancient Israel. And this was significant because the first two commandments were a contradiction to the lifestyle of the Egyptians that had many different gods, just like the Greeks and the Romans. In fact, with the Greeks, they were so confused, they had so many, that they even allowed for one to an unknown god, just in case they forgot or didn't that there would be some other god that they had not accounted for. But in Exodus chapter 20, we can see at verse 2, I am the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the land of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. Verse 4, and you shall not make unto you any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in the heaven above or in the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. And you shall not bow down yourself to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. It's interesting, he uses the word jealous. And he inspired the Apostle Paul to use the same concept when Paul was pleading with the people in Corinth and saying, I am jealous over you with a godly jealousy, that I have espoused you as a wife to her husband, Jesus Christ. And he mentions that in 2 Corinthians 11. And God is a very passionate God. We can overlook that sometimes. He feels very strongly about the relationship that we can have with him. And it's what he did not have with the ancient Israelites because they lacked his Holy Spirit. And in Deuteronomy 5:29, he says, oh, I wish that they had a heart in them, that they would keep my statutes and obey my laws, forever. They and their children, that it might be well with them. He's very passionate about his relationship with us. And when we put sin out of our lives, and when we take inventory, and we start shedding false gods, then we can ramp up the enthusiasm that we have to be with God, so that it's a mutual two-way street, two-way relationship. Considering the danger of false idols and the damage that they can do to individuals, I'd like to take a little bit of time to consider the historical transition of Israel leaving Egypt. That is something that we contemplate at this time of year. There's so many different lessons that we can derive out of reading Exodus, because we're coming out of spiritual Egypt. We have to be doing that all the time, all year long. But it's especially on our minds at this time of year. And understanding the plight of the Israelites is quite interesting, because they were in bondage. And those that sin, including us, to the extent that we sin, or when we do, we can put ourselves in slavery to that sin, or be in bondage to the repercussions of sinning. And of course, we are elated beyond measure that Jesus Christ gave us a way out. He paid the penalty so that we don't have that hanging over our heads indefinitely. So that's a real blessing. But it's sobering to understand that these different false gods can hold us back. And they, back with the ancient Israelites, the Egyptians had many false gods. And that became a curse unto them. Not right away, but their false gods became a curse unto them. Let's take a look for a few minutes here at the plight of the Israelites in the book of Exodus. Exodus chapter 12. No, not 12. Go back to chapter 3. In chapter 3, God revealed himself to Moses. And he said in verse 14 at the burning bush, I am that I am. This is Exodus 3:14. And he said, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, the I am has sent me unto you. And God said to Moses, moreover, you shall say to the children of Israel, the Lord of God, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has sent me to you. And to moving to verse 16, in the middle of it, the Lord your God says, I have surely visited you and have seen what is done unto you in Egypt. And I will bring you up out of the land of affliction of Egypt unto the land of the Canaanites. And in several different passages before and after this excerpt, we can read where God acknowledged the fact that the Israelites were under terrible slavery and were in misery. And so, in verse 19, he goes on to tell Moses, I am sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go. No, not by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with all of my wonders which I will do in the midst thereof, and afterwards he will let you go. That must have sounded almost unbelievable. Here they were just in a misery, in a terrible state of existence with absolutely no hope on the horizon. And the Israelites themselves had, for the most part, lost sight of God and his way of life, his commandments. They weren't keeping the Sabbath. They were very detached from him, and yet wondering how, you know, much longer they could endure. And for even Moses to hear God say that in verse 21, and I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and it shall come to pass that when you go, you shall not go empty, but that they would spoil the Egyptians. That was incredible. But Moses wasn't sure, and the elders of Israel were not sure how this would play out. And when Moses initially went to Pharaoh, he was angry. He says, who is this God of Israel that I should let these people go? And I don't recognize that God. And he spurned the idea that they would leave. In fact, we see this in Exodus chapter 5 and verse 1. Afterwards, Moses and Aaron finally appeared to Pharaoh. To me, it's amazing that they even had clearance to get into the court. Perhaps it was because of Moses' prior reputation when he was at the Pharaoh's court. But now this was a different Pharaoh, more than likely, and Moses was considered part of the Israelite nation, and so they would not look on him with great favor, but instead disdain. But at any rate, with God's help, Moses and Aaron had an audience with Pharaoh. In verse 2, Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I know not the Lord, neither will I let Israel go. Pharaoh was infuriated, and he demanded that from then on they work harder than ever, and all the Israelites make bricks without straw. They'd have to gather their own material. As if it weren't already difficult, they would have to work day and night to make their quota. And if they weren't, couldn't make enough bricks, they would be beaten, perhaps to death. So it was a very dire time. And one thing that we'll see in various places, God would say over and over again, I will do my wonders in Egypt so that they will know. They will know who I am. He remembered what Pharaoh said. Who is this person? I don't have to obey God. He's nothing. And hasn't society said that in so many ways and methods? People that claim we don't need to have in God we trust on our money anymore. Because that's not who we are. We're our own people. We set our own destiny, our own course. And so we've become increasingly secular. And that's what happens when other false gods replace the true God. And that bodes very badly for the country in the future. unless there is repentance or a change. We saw a wonderful movie this week. It was put out by a Christian organization, a true story, and rated G, and excellent movie about with a lot of values, great for children and teens and youth and everybody. And I think of people that produce efforts like that, just like the movie Fireproof. And I think, you know, at least there are other people that really trying to do the right thing. They may not have the understanding about the Sabbath and the holy days and all, but certainly I pray that God will bless segments of the country. If we can't bless the entire country, because a lot of the people today in this nation would probably say with great defiance, I don't know the Lord any more than Pharaoh. And it's important that a nation learn from the past so it does not repeat those mistakes. So we see that here in chapter 5, Pharaoh is defiant, and he makes life even more miserable for the Israelites. And so in chapter 6 and verse 1, then the Lord said to Moses, now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand shall he let them go. But certain major events would have to happen. And so we move on to chapter 7. And this begins the 10 plagues of Egypt. In chapter 7 and verse 1, the Lord said to Moses, see that I have made you a god to Pharaoh. I don't think that registered with Moses yet. But these people were superstitious. And up until now, Pharaoh was probably thinking, that fool Moses, what does he think he's doing? He's making his life, he's his people's worst enemy. And that silly god that he claims to represent, why, Israel has no chance to ever have any prominence with that particular god, whoever it is. But on the other hand, we have the god Ra, the sun god. And we have Hatep, which is also a wonderful god, god of fertility. And we have the moon god, and we have other gods that help us with our crops. We have a river god for the Nile. And no wonder we're a great nation. We have so many gods that are willing to help us. And they have this puny god that is leaving them in abject misery. Therefore, he's thinking, they have no chance. They have no future. Not with this god of Abraham or whoever he is. Meaningless. And so Pharaoh was totally deceived. And he did not know that God was going to chip away at their gods one by one. God had heard. God doesn't always act when people think he should. But when he does, there is no doubt. And it's complete. And when God acts, he's the only one standing when the dust settles. So in chapter 7, it says in verse 2 now, you shall speak all that I command you, and Aaron your brother shall speak to Pharaoh, that he send out the children out of the land, of Israel out of his hand. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt. But Pharaoh shall not hearken unto you, that I may lay my hand upon Egypt and their false gods, and bring forth my armies, his angels, and my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great judgments. And notice this, and the Egyptians shall know that I am God. And after the great tribulation and the heavenly signs that we read about in Revelation, Joel and Amos and the other prophets, then the whole world shall know that God is the true God. God will triumph. He will intervene. And he did here in ancient Israel. So, as it turns out in verse 14 of this chapter, the Lord said unto Moses, Pharaoh's heart is hardened. Go to Pharaoh this morning, verse 15, as he goes out to the water to stand by the river's bank, and then go out there with and take your rod which was turned into a serpent at Pharaoh's court, and you shall take it in your hand, and you shall say to him, the Lord God of Israel, of the Hebrews, has sent me unto you, saying, let my people go, that they might serve me in the wilderness, and behold, you would not hear. Thus saith the Lord, that you shall know that I am the Lord. Behold, I will smite the rod that is upon the waters which are in the river, and they shall be turned to blood. And the fish that is in the river shall die, and the river shall stink, and the Egyptians shall loathe to drink the water of the river. Now the river was a huge blessing, and it always has been. It has been essential that the river bring in fertile silt into that region to grow crops, to provide the necessary irrigation for expanded territory on either side of the Nile River. It has always been that way, and it was certainly that way back then, because unlike other nations, it was able to prosper with great agriculture. Well, Israel, the land of Canaan to some extent, but certainly this area was very, very rich in agriculture. And so it was a huge blessing to them. And again, they had a god called Hapi. Hapi, which was the river god of the Nile. And when the Nile River turned to blood, that had to be a huge affront to Hapi. No, really. If Hapi existed, that is. But the Nile River became a national crisis because it threatened their water supply. And it destroyed the fish. And people didn't want to be near the river or do commerce on the river. And perhaps people were praying like crazy, Hapi, please, please rectify the situation. Don't let this puny God of Abraham that comes out of nowhere to get the upper hand on this country and on this river. And it went on for about a week. And finally Pharaoh begged Moses, please do something about it. And so he did. But for a number of days, there was such a stench because of that river turning into blood. I don't know if it was type O or AB or what, but it was very definite. And it really shattered the morale of the people. You know, when there's an earthquake, you know, it's national news if it's in this country. And thus far, they've affected small regions. But something like this could even be much more catastrophic. So after that, then everybody in Egypt was breathing a sigh of relief. They weren't expecting something else to happen. In chapter 8, in verse 1, it says, and the Lord spoke again to Moses, go to Pharaoh and say, thus says the Lord, let my people go that they might serve me. And if you refuse to let them go, I will smite all of the borders with frogs. And the river shall bring forth frogs abundantly, which shall go up and come into your house and into your bedchamber and upon your bed and in the house of your servants and upon your people and in your ovens and in your kneading trough. It sounds pretty complete to me. And the frogs shall come upon you and the other people, all of your servants. What a dreadful prophecy that was. And there was a god of Egypt called Haket, who was the goddess, she was a goddess of fertility. And the idols of Haket that were made had the frontal appearance of a frog. So God was going to basically rub it in their faces. And so he brought out these hordes of frogs. Billions, maybe trillions of frogs, or beyond that. And they were everywhere. And it just interrupted commerce and life in general for these people. I can well imagine somebody saying, Pharaoh, we need... ribbit, ribbit, you hear all these sounds everywhere and in the chamber. I have something to say. Splat. I have something... How'd that get in there? You know, I can't think. We can't do anything. We got to get this man Moses. This nation's going down. This Haket has blown it. He has turned against us. He's no god. If he's a goddess of, if she's a goddess of fertility, it's for a bad cause. It's turned against Egypt. frankly, I don't even know if Hakhet exists. And so they were pleading then with Moses, oh, this is no good. Please, call off the dogs, so to speak. Get these things out of here. And so miraculously that happened. But there was a stench for days thereafter. That stench made a lot of people think, wow, blood smelled bad, but frogs? This is awful. This is miserable. We're going into slavery ourselves here. We're victimized. And so then the frogs finally left, and Pharaoh decided to harden his heart. And so then, when verse 15, when Pharaoh saw that there was a respite, he hearkened to his heart instead of to Moses, and not unto the Lord. And so then God said to Moses, verse 16, say to Aaron, stretch out your rod and smite the dust of the land that it might become lice throughout all the land of Egypt. I know when children are assessed in schools as having lice, you know, there's a certain amount of mild panic among the other kids, their parents and teachers and so on, and it's something that has to be quarantined. And it can happen to anybody, but I can't imagine wholesale lice where it's everybody wrestling with it, where you see the blue sky just covered the landscape with these tiny little creatures, and they're just everywhere in people's hair and in their clothing, and I won't go any further. People are wincing. Well, and believe it or not, you can check this, that one of the gods of magic in the Egyptian culture was Thoth, T-H-O-T-H, which depicted lice, that even had a lice appearance. And so, people in Egypt were maybe even praying to Thoth, please, please, reverse your vengeance against us. But what are the odds that Thoth would be against us, and that Hapi would be against us, and these other gods? Maybe they don't exist. I don't understand it. Everything's going wrong for us. And after that, in verse 20, then the next plague was flies. Verse 20, and the Lord said to Moses, rise up early and stand before Pharaoh when he comes forth to the water, to the river, and say to him, let my people go. No doubt, every time Pharaoh laid eyes on Moses, it was like, oh, not again. What this time? Even Ahab said something similar. Are you the one that troubles Israel? Oh, or every time he or Micaiah ever says anything, it's always bad. Bad news. So bad news, Moses came and said that there would be another curse. And so it was, that flies would appear. Now, the flies seem to coincide with the Egyptian god of the resurrection, and that had a beetle head front. And the name of that false god was Kherpe, K-H-E-P-R-E, Kherpe. Well, we know from the rest of the account that Kherpe was a very huge disappointment to the Egyptians, because he let them down. He let all of these horrible flies infest all of Egypt. Then we move on to chapter 9, where then the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh and tell him, let my people go. And if you refuse, then the hand of the Lord is upon the cattle in the field, and the horses, and the various other animals, that there would be a grievous murrain, a disease, a sickness that would kill these animals. And this was an affront against Apis, which was the Egyptian god of bulls and other livestock. Boy, if there was ever a time for Apis to jump into the ring of fire and save the day for Egypt, it was now. Because you couldn't just continue as a great empire with one heavy blow after another, knocking the country down a stage at a time. Unfortunately, Pharaoh did not heed. And in verse 7, it says, and Pharaoh sent, and behold, there was not one of the Israelites dead, or the cattle of the Israelites. And yet, verse 6, all of the cattle of Egypt died. but of Israel not one. There were several distinctions in these plagues, that the Israelites would be protected where they lived, but the Egyptians, if they did not heed, would pay a severe price. Following this, chapter 9, verses 8 through 11, Moses pronounced the next plague, and he threw up dust in the air and that spread and created boils that were on man and beast throughout the land of Egypt. I had the experience one time of having a boil. It was several decades ago. And that was just one. And that was an ordeal for about a week, almost a week. And to be having multiple boils like this had to be sheer agony, sheer torture, obviously bringing the country to its knees. And all the while, the Israelites were thinking, you know, God really is powerful. And we have the time to contemplate that because we're not in slavery now. They are so preoccupied with self-survival, they're not enslaving us. And they were able to ponder, to think, wow, it's been horrible here. We've been in slavery. We've been in a land of slavery. We've been in a land of confusion, of false idols. And now our God is standing up for us. He is a great God. I think they were quite in awe of him. So much that even though the Israelites are considered a griping people, complaining, you know, murmur, gossip, whatever, the one time that they were as well behaved as little angels was when they marched out of Egypt. Everybody was in sync. Everybody was together. There was no murmuring. I think it was because they were in awe of the greatness of God. And that's what happens, even in our time. When we see how great God is, we're not so inclined to get fixated on insignificant nonsense. That we have it together. We're riveted on what's important. When we see the greatness of God, that sometimes comes in fasting, when we see and feel how puny we are. I say those that can, with their health permitting, fast. But just reviewing the greatness of God and His creation in its many different ways. So the boils that occurred was a slap in the face of the goddess Isis. Isis was the goddess of medicine and peace. And what kind of good health from medicine could there be when everybody and his brother and sister were encumbered with boils? So that was a huge trial. Following that was the trial of hail. Hail that was an affront to the god Shunut, who is the god of the air and the god of the sky. If Shunut did exist, he should have been able to protect the nation of Egypt from the terrible hail that wiped out so many other crops. It's interesting in chapter 9, verse 20 of Exodus. He that feared the word of the Lord among the servants of Pharaoh made his servants and his cattle to flee into the houses. That's where they could be protected. And by this point in time, there were some Egyptians that said, well, Pharaoh may have a hardened heart, but all of this happening is just too much for mere coincidence. And those people probably were the ones that completed the mixed multitude that left Egypt. They were connecting the dots all along here. But it's interesting in verse 23 and 24. It says, so Moses stretched forth his rod to heaven, and the Lord sent thunder and hail and fire, ran along the ground. How scary. And the Lord rained hail upon the land of Egypt, so that there was hail and fire that mingled with the hail, very grievous, like none like it in all the land of Egypt since it became a nation. And finally, a Pharaoh called for Moses, and he was in a panic. Verse 27, I have sinned this time. The Lord is righteous. I and my people are wicked. That's quite a statement of somebody that was so defiant. Who is this God anyway? To go from that to this, he says, entreat the Lord, for it is enough. For there be no more mighty thunderings and hail. I will let you go, and you shall stay no longer. Verse 29, and Moses said, as soon as I am gone out of the city, I will spread abroad my hands to the Lord, and the thunder shall cease, neither shall there be any hail, that you may know that the earth is the Lord's. But as for you and your servants, I know that you will not fear the Lord your God, Lord God. And sure enough, Pharaoh changed his mind. He had a hard heart, a heart of iron. And so he changed his mind. He decided that he was not going to let them go. And so following this in chapter 10, there were locusts that swarmed in on Egypt. The Egyptians had a god that they worshipped called Senehem, whose face looked like that of a locust insect. But apparently their god of Senehem was unable to control all the activity of all the other billions of locusts that came and devoured whatever was left of the crops that had not been devoured by the or destroyed by the hail. And then after that, in chapter 10 and verse 21, we can read, and the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand before heaven, that there might be darkness over the land of Egypt, even darkness that might be felt. And Moses stretched forth his hand to heaven, and there was a thick darkness in all the land of Egypt 3 days. They saw not one another, neither rose any from his place for 3 days. But all of the children of Israel had light in their dwellings. Another testimony to the greatness of God. And I suppose for those days, it's like, Pharaoh, are you there? Are you there? Oh, that's the wall. Where I hear your voice? I can't see my hand. Where are you? What? Now, who would suffer the most ignominious shame over all that darkness? It would be the sun god, Ra. Talk about a god that was not doing his job. Here, this entire civilization of Egypt was groping in the darkness, and the god that they had worshipped, that they had given so much credit to, could not give them not even a match, not even a ray of light, nothing. Well, maybe Ra doesn't exist. Maybe Moses' God is the true God. Maybe Isis doesn't exist either, and Hatep, and all these other gods, and the god of the river, and the god of the moon, and the goddess of fertility. The goddess of fertility was next, because we know that the ultimate plague was the death of the firstborn. An enormous blow to the nation of Egypt. And the god of reproduction, actually, it was god by the name of Min. And Min was given a lot of credit for multiplying the Egyptians. But Min either was helpless or did not exist. Everything that Pharaoh attributed to the true God would only apply to the false gods. And it's amazing even today how society and many in society dedicate large amounts of time to trying to discredit the fact that God exists. That are more interested in worshiping the created instead of the Creator. So coming out of Egypt for the Israelites definitely meant coming out of a land of false gods. A land of false gods. The false gods of Egypt could not save the country because they were not real. And yet because they existed in the minds of the Egyptians, they were dangerous because they created harm. They created misery. They created slavery for the Egyptians in a sense. They blinded the Egyptians from most of them from giving allegiance to the true God. Today it's still ironic. People do not get excited about the God that does exist but gives allegiance to other gods that don't exist or to the gods that man can literally create. It's important that we not repeat the mistakes of the Egyptians, but the world will. What do we know, for example, in the book of Revelation in the end time? that the entire world, or most of the entire world, shouldn't, with maybe some exceptions in Asia, that a large part of the world will worship the beast. It may be superficial, based on the charisma of the leadership, but it says in Revelation 13, who is like the beast? Oh, this, we have a system of worship. We have a system of government. We have a system that's going to be the ticket to prosperity and security and unity and, for the entire world. And people will be in the state of euphoria in the beginning, and then in Revelation 17 it says, and they will finally see the beast for what it is, and they will hate the beast. It's not hard to turn against a false god. When you see the reality of it, you see how it's enslaved one, and see how ugly that is. And there are other false gods that are not gods made with as graven images, but false gods that maybe even we could have that creep up on us and take our attention, our time. As Isaiah 45 and verse 20 says, most people have no knowledge that set up, for example, wood of their graven image and pray to a god that cannot save. And let's not forget, God is jealous of the Israelites. And it was understandably extremely upset when they, after seeing the 10 plagues of Egypt, seeing the crossing of the Red Sea, seeing manna come down from heaven, all these divine miracles, many of them reverted back and built a golden calf. You think, how obtuse is that? Perhaps egged on by the mixed multitude that thought, you know, God did some mighty things in Egypt, but we like our past customs. We need to go back to Egypt. We need to go back to that which is comfortable. We need to have some other gods, ones that we can tangibly see. Others thought that way. In Romans 6 and verse 16, it says, whatever you obey is your God. And I can turn there, Romans 6:16. It's said in different language, but it's basically saying that, know you not that to whom you yield yourselves servants to obey, his servants are to whom you obey. Whether of sin unto death or obedience unto righteousness, it depends on which God you're chasing down. And there are a number of false gods in our society. There are some that depend not on God to know the future, but depend on soothsayers and seances and other people. And again, I think it angers God that he's not their object of worship. And so he says, and you can turn there if you wish, Isaiah 47, verses 10 through 14. For you have trusted in your wickedness, as, for if you have said, nobody sees me, you know, I can do whatever I want. Thy wisdom and your knowledge, it has perverted you. And you have said in your heart, I am, and there is no one else beside me. God says, for those who would think that way, that think that there is a world without God, the true God, therefore evil shall come upon you sooner or later, that you shall not know from whence it rises, and mischief shall fall upon you. In a society that we have that is under so many curses, if we walk away from a relationship with the true God, then we can easily reap bad repercussion. It says, verse 12, he's saying this sarcastically, stand now with your enchantments and the multitude of sorceries wherein you have labored from your youth. If you so shall be able to profit, if you shall be able to prevail, for you are wearied in a multitude of your counsels. And he says here, he's mocking them, let now your astrologers and stargazers and monthly prognosticators stand up and save you from the things that will come upon you. And you shall be as stubble that fire can burn. In other words, God is saying to them, well, you can make the wrong choices, but why? Why? Connect the dots. Whatever we obey is our God. Whatever we give our great allegiance to. We had a minister one time doing a world tour and was in the other side of the planet, and he went into a remote area, and visited with people that had very little contact with civilization up in the mountains in Southeast Asia. And they were called, looked like they were called into the church. And they seemed to have a reasonable understanding of the Bible. But they surprised the pastor by saying, "Well, we're really, really excited. We have something we want to show you." "Oh, well, what is it?" "Well, it's secret. You can't tell anybody. But it's like our ace in the hole, you know." And so they walked back into this back room. It was a dirt floor. And over in the corner, they're digging out dirt. And they pull up a bag. They untie the bag. And says, "See?" Pours it on the table. And it was little pieces of glass. It was rose-colored glass. You know, no big deal. In that area, that was a medium of exchange. That was money there. They had other forms of money, but they still were using glass. And this guy had never seen anything like it. And it was like, this is our salvation. This is what's going to get us through the tribulation. We're going to be able to buy and sell with these little pieces. And it's there, you know, so this is our thing. And he looked at him and said, "How do I tell you this? But you, not only is this probably not going to work, you seem to have a fixation and an inordinate trust in this, in these little pieces of glass. But to God, all the false idols are just as meaningless as these pieces of glass. It is inherent in human beings to want to worship something." You read in the book of Acts where Paul and Barnabas came to this town and people wanted to worship them. "Oh, this one must be Jupiter, and because of the miracle he just performed, and the other one's Mercury." No. I had a friend that actually made a living flying hot air balloons, and he was called upon to go down to Central America for a promotion, and his balloon got blown way off course and landed in some remote area where white people had never been, Aztecs, or Mayans rather, and so they thought that he was a god, the little village. They had never seen anybody like him. And he said it was an eerie feeling. And they surrounded his hot air balloon with armed tribesmen with spears. That's what they had, so that nobody could steal the, you know, celestial craft that landed among them. And they brought these to him as assistant into this village, and they were going to crown him as their king and give them all these wives. He said it was really creepy. He says we could walk anywhere we wanted in this village, and there were thousands of people, and they would open up if they thought we wanted to go here, and they'd create this human swath. And then if they saw us go in another direction, and they were looking for any vestige of civilization, and this person, his assistant, had a ham operating a radio, and he scrambled for the next hour calling for help, and this was in Honduras, and militia finally got their coordinates, came and rescued them, left the balloon, but took them. But it's inherent in people to want to trust something, and if they're not going to trust in God, they're going to find something. It's going to be status. Maybe it's the ultimate speedboat. There's nothing wrong with boats. There's nothing wrong with money. It's the abuse, misuse of any of these things that could make them false gods. Mr. Armstrong said that everybody has an idol before God gets their attention, usually. He said he tried three times to become wealthy. He had as his false idol the desire to hobnob with the wealthy and to be among them, to be thought well of, and to make a lot of money, and he was well on his way. And then when that was taken away, as he put it, from him, he rebounded, tried to do it again, and it was going to be first with advertising, then it was going to be a laundry business, and then it was going to be this clay business where he could manufacture bottles of this healing clay that came from various mud pits that seemed to have unusual chemical qualities to it that would be able to heal skin. And so he got amazing results, but it seemed like an unseen hand was squelching that. That was his idol. I remember one minister saying before God got his attention and called him, he was in high, or about that time, he was in high school, and he was in always excelled in athletics, and especially track and field events. And he was predicted to win the discus throw. The discus where you spin around, wind, and then you hurl this thing that goes, a disc goes about, well, in his case, in high school, 200 feet. That would be winning a throw. And because he was so good at it and had been so successful, winning one event after another, during the state championship, they had all the press corps out there to cover him. And he said it was the most disillusioning day of his life. You know, Mr. Armstrong said it was like, I was King Midas in reverse. Somebody was taking away my idols. Well, this guy wanted a scholarship. He was wanting to be as famous as possible. He looked forward to having his name in the newspaper. And that was his God at that point. And so in front of the press, in front of his friends and all the classmates, he showed his ability. He wound up and he spun and he flung this thing, and it had a great takeoff, and then it hit something invisible and went, instead of going out like that, it went bang, and it went like that. He looked up at it and everybody's jaws dropped. Well, bad atmosphere, let's do it again. You get a couple throws. He wound up again, he let that thing go, and it went bang, and went back down. He had scratched. And the last one he scratched. He was out of the competition. He didn't even place. It was gone. His future, the adulation, the fame, and that was horrible. I know for another person, his big thing was basketball, and the high school championship was on the line, and he got sick and couldn't be there. When God gets one's attention, sometimes he will pull the idols out. But as years go by and we're in the church and we become more mature, he says, you know, I could pull the idol away from them myself, but I want them to do it. And that takes more character. He wants us to examine ourselves. And he says this much in the book of Corinthians. Idolatry is misplaced worship. John Calvin made the statement, the human heart is a factory of idols. A factory of idols. I think that was just being honest. False idols can lead to death. And we saw that with ancient Egypt. I can well imagine the second resurrection. During the 100-year period, two people could be meeting each other soon after the resurrection, compare notes. Well, how did you die? Well, I was killed for worshiping Aaron's golden calf. And you? Oh, well, I died in a pagan orgy with Baal worship over at Shechem during Ahab's reign. Well, I guess we have a lot in common. Well, what is our idol? What are our idols? Plural. Like leavening, they have to be purged. It could be status, it could be people, could be things. It might be charismatic personalities. There was one church in the 1800s that people used to flock to hear this one minister, Henry Ward Beecher. And he seemed to be effective week after week after week. One day a substitute minister walked in, and when he did, and people realized that Mr. Beecher wasn't going to be there, they all started to leave. And so the substitute said, at the beginning, he says, all those that came to worship Mr. Beecher this morning may leave. All those that want to worship the Lord may stay. And everybody sat back down. We can worship personalities. We can worship a boss. Some people worship LeBron James, the basketball center originally drafted by the Cleveland Cavaliers and signed for $90 million. I mentioned my friend who is worshipped by natives with his hot air balloon. Some people worship work. In Japan, this is a huge, huge factor in their society. They've even come up with a new word for the word work or overwork, and that's karosh. Karosh. But work is so important to that culture. There's a popular fight song, a corporate fight song. You've heard of fight songs for high school. You know, I remember ours: fight, fight, fight for the purple and the white, BHS forevermore. Nobody's ever heard of that for good reason. At any rate, they have a fight song that goes something like this. I don't know how the music of it is, but the lyrics are, "Can you work 24 hours a day for your corporation?" Yeah. You know, that's everybody's meal ticket. That's what's important. And they have a high degree of stress, a large segment of the population. They've gotten away from their roots, away from what served them so well as far as lifestyle of the past. If we this season are able to rid ourselves of idols, then what was said to others, the words of Christ, would apply to us. And you shall seek the truth, and the truth shall set you free. When we don't have our idols pulling us down, we're free. We're free. Sometimes they're hard to pull down because it's like we're giving up so much. But God says that false idols are bad. You can't have them. I can't have them. And so if we're going to really worship God, we have to do it on His terms. We have to come out in the open with our hands up, so to speak. And we're saying as much by our presence at Passover. We're saying, I'm done with false idols with your help. Help me to see them. Help me to be comfortable and enthusiastic about a life without them. And that's being is a healthy way to look at things. Now, coming to Him on His terms involves us asking God for His help, for His guidance. In John 16:13, it says God's Spirit guides those, leads those, guides those. He guides into all truth. John 16:13. Now that's a blessing that we can have that, because it's with God's Spirit that we're going to get anywhere. So we need to ask God for His help. I remember one woman, I have no idea what she was wrestling with, but she said, I had this horrible craving and I didn't know if it would ever leave, and I just kept asking God until it did. I'm sure that story has been repeated thousands and tens of thousands of times, but the way she described it with such intensity, it still made an impression on me, and that was decades ago. Having a healthy respect or fear of the excess of pursuits in wrong areas is important. We can't, as I mentioned in the beginning, it was this one settlement of people that had no television, but they had the TV antenna. And then that was, they wanted to look good among their neighbors. And so that was one of their gods. And as silly as it is, we might have a TV antenna that keeps us out of the kingdom. I don't think so. But we don't want to be careless. We got to be careful. We want to be sure. There are many, many equivalents of the frog god or the Nile River god or a modern-day Isis. Our secret gods may be unnoticed by others, but if we have them, we got to get rid of them. Idolatry has its price tag, and hence that's the title of the sermon. It does have its price tag. Idolatry can ultimately lead to spiritual death. It can waste our time. It can deceive us. It can kill. It can make others miserable. If you let it, it will always shortchange. It can prevent entry into God's kingdom. So we have to be on guard and ask for God's help against the dangers of idolatry and the manifestations of it, no matter how subtle they are. It's a challenge to do that perfectly. It only is with God's Spirit that we can be successful. But certainly an enthusiastic effort pleases God, because He is a jealous God and He wants a relationship with His people. And for most of the history of the human race, He has not had that with the majority that have ever lived. So He does appreciate it when we make our efforts. He knows we're not perfect, but he is patient and he's very kind and loving. But he wants to involve us with him, and it's only best handled when he is our one and only true God. So let us remember these events, consider the fallacy of chasing the wind as the ancient Egyptians did. It finally caught up with them, and it brought them to their knees, and it actually brought death to many of them. Let us instead more enthusiastically worship the true God so that he can more enthusiastically include us among his people.